Welcome back to the Paula Gordon Show. Our guest is William H. Kelvin, who is concerned that there are lots of things going on in the climate about which we apparently don't quite know enough. As we went away, I was saying, when everybody's in charge, nobody's in charge. Well, it seems to me that until somebody says, yes, there's a problem, and we are going to address it, until somebody takes responsibility for this, this is a global problem, and nobody's in charge of it.
Well, it's a global problem, but if the countries that border the North Atlantic have a particularly vested interest in this. I mean,
they'd rather not be under ice.
If NATO wanted a new mission in life or something, it could sort of take over supporting this sort of thing. And I'm sure the European Union is going to have a lot of concerns about this, because Europe is downwind and it gets hit first. And it's because it's settled at such a high latitude, it's much more vulnerable. There'll be a larger temperature excursion there than there will be elsewhere. But basically, what everybody thought as they looked at the situation before was that this ought to be a problem for Europe, but they didn't see it was going to be a problem for the rest of the world. And that's because all the temperature measurements of the ancient climate sort of come from Greenland. I mean, when we first saw these big glitches in the Greenland temperature, people thought, gee, Greenland has a funny climate. I hope this doesn't extend further. And then it was discovered by looking elsewhere with some care that some of the same sharp changes in temperature really were occurring elsewhere. And then as they looked even more closely, they discovered that even down in New Zealand in the southern hemisphere, they were occurring more or less at the same time that they were occurring in Europe. So that it really is a worldwide change in a short time, which is very interesting. I mean, first of all, it means that the rest of the world is just as vulnerable as the United States is, for example. And it also means that the mechanism of the cooling must be something that probably involves the entire atmosphere. This is not a regional change where, one country gets the rainfall while another country gets, a drought. This is something that seems to change on a global basis, and it probably involves greenhouse gases. It's the water vapor is the major greenhouse gas. It's not CO2, as you might think. CO2 is simply the one that we have some control over at present, and that's why we concentrate on it. But the changes in water vapor may, in fact, be what is causing the big cooling.
In another context, you say that the atmosphere, biosphere, ocean sphere together are sort of like the Old Testament God, full of lots of rules and no mercy.
Yes, well, certainly when these coolings happen, it starts out being like a drought. And the only trouble is it just keeps getting worse rather than getting better. And it keeps getting worse for 10, 15 years before it bottoms out. And then it stays at the bottom for decades, centuries. And then, as I say, it suddenly warms back up just over a few decades, too.
Well, again, the context of this is we've had more or less 15,000 years when the weather's been pretty nice with a couple of blips.
Maybe 8,000 years.
All right, 8,000 years. Okay. These are big numbers for me. I don't do numbers. We're pretty used to the fact that it is as it is and more or less evermore shall be.
Yes, our agriculture got started basically at the end of the last ice age, which is sort of about 10,000 years ago, basically, is when most of the ice had retreated. And things had warmed up nicely. The warm-up started at 15,000 years ago when there was still an enormous amount of ice around. The temperature popped up almost to modern levels.
You're trying to bail me out, aren't you?
What I'm trying to show is how temperature and ice don't necessarily go together.
Thank you.
The temperature can pop up with a lot of ice still present and then may cool back down and back up again. And if you keep it warm for long enough, the ice will melt and it will go back to the... It took about 6,000 years to melt off the big ice sheets and go back to sort of our present state of ice, which is Antarctica and Greenland and such. You can also have, in the middle of warm periods like today's, you can have these abrupt coolings that go back to ice age temperatures. Now, when you say ice age, you immediately think of the ice coming back, but it's really just a return to ice age temperature. And if you maintain that for a very long time, you'll also get ice with it. But typically, it flips back before you get there. So what we're talking about here is big changes in temperature. It's just like jacking the landscape up and down a few thousand feet at a time, you know, for a 5 or 10 year period.
Our experience is that people don't act on something this substantive until there's a crisis. And I think what I'm hearing you say is by the time the crisis hits, it'll be a little late to be acting. So, I mean, I would expect, for example, that the Europeans, particularly because they have the vested interests, they've got, you know, the science, the institutions, lots of things, the European Union, so they're in a position nominally to act collectively, that they would be all over this.
Yes, I would think so. Certainly more than half of the scientists that have been studying this have been Europeans. Some of the major climate modelers are the Germans and so forth. I mean, they have been thoroughly involved with the story. But I actually don't think the story is known any better there than it is in the United States.
So there's still nothing really concerted going on, even in Europe?
I mean, you know, my article in the Atlantic Monthly was sort of the first major publication that had a thorough story on this.
So what kind of response have you gotten?
Quite a lot, actually. It's been very interesting. But there's an enormous amount of misunderstanding there. I mean, there's people that confuse all different parts of the story, as you might expect, and it's just going to take a while to try to straighten people out so that they realize that temperature and ice don't necessarily go together, and that there's vulnerabilities in things like the North Atlantic Current that can lead to really rapid, you know, change in climate.
Well, and this is unfamiliar. I mean, I think most of us think of the oceans as being relatively homogeneous.
Homogeneous, they're not. homogeneous, I mean, you sort of tend to think that, you know, you sort of drop some salt in the water and it'll sort of spread out. And, you know,
what's at equilibrium?
And
the assumption is.
It's not. The ocean is full of blobs, for example, of fresher water than, I mean, let's say water that isn't salty. That will circulate around the North Atlantic for 10, 15 years, making a big circuit of about, you know, they move about 1 inch, a minute or something. And they're still well-defined after 10 or 15 years. They just don't mix because they're so big and they can only mix from the edges, and so therefore it's a slow process.
I found myself, I'm familiar with your work and have been for some time, but I found myself reading the article, which is not a particularly technical article, but I was reading, I think I was moving my lips when I was reading it, because these are it's you know, it's the climate, it's the oceans, it's the interrelationship between and among them. It is a historical record that is still a relatively new idea for non-scientists and apparently for scientists as well. It would seem that there's just a real challenge to generate any interest or activity.
It's also a non-linear system, and to the extent that we think about these things, we think of very incremental kinds of systems, like the global warming story has been so far, of one thing slowly leads to another, slowly to another. But our lives are full of non-linear things, like light switches and door latches and so forth, that sort of give way all of a sudden and change. Full flickering light bulbs and so forth, which are basically the appropriate analogies. And we understand from a lot of other systems of how you can stabilize things so that they don't flip, so you can keep them well away from the region where they might flip, so that even when an El Nino or something comes along, it doesn't push you over the edge. You know, that's the sort of thing that I think we can do with this abrupt part of the climate problem, even though I'm not sure what we can effectively do about some of the other parts, whether we'll succeed in correcting the global warming or the El Niños. But I do think we can do something about the abrupt part.
We sort of, I think, have a challenge. We're living in a time when the market model seems to have gained ascendancy, and it's hard to see the economic payoff of acting. You know, it's hard to imagine a business that is going to step boldly forward and take the kinds of actions you suggest. It seems to me that this is something that governments and collections of governments have to do.
I'm not sure you have to wait for a world government to do something about a worldwide problem. I think it's quite possible that something like NATO, you know, might effectively, you know, tackle the problem because it's in, you know, NATO's backyard. Yeah. It's even named appropriately. It's the North Atlantic.
You know,
it's the vulnerable part of this. I mean, I should say that the North Atlantic is just part of a worldwide conveyor of salt water. And when the North Atlantic part of it shuts down, the rest of the current rearranges itself. And it's a current that reaches all the way through the Indian Ocean and the Pacific. And it's presumably the rearrangements in that current that actually trigger the cooling. The first part of it is simply the failure in the North Atlantic, but within just a few years, all the rest of it has changed the whole relationship between the ocean and the atmosphere. And that change, probably in tropical evaporation, is what actually does the cooling.
I don't want to overstate this, but in a sense, this sounds like there's an organic, almost, relationship between all the various pieces.
Well, it's a complicated
They're interconnected.
System, but you know, we deal with much more complicated ones in biology.
And when we come back, we get to talk a little bit about okay. that. Our guest is William H. Calvin. We are at the Commerce Club in Atlanta. Bill Russell has, of course, joined me, and we're going to be back shortly with William Calvin. Please stay tuned.